The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi. Okay. Korea was partitioned in 1945, and I'm going to start us off with a few points about the 50 years before that. Diana will pick up from there and carry us to the end of the Cold War, and I'll finish with stuff that's happened since 1989. We're talking about imperialism and resistance, so let's start with imperialism. Modern imperialism began as a competition among European capitalist powers. Each power tried to exploit other countries in order to produce a flow of profit back to the home country. This led to a scramble for colonies, which was most intense from the 1880s up until the outbreak of World War I. The Western powers carved up parts of Asia and almost all of Africa. Nevertheless, in Korea, the colonizers were Japanese. In the 1860s, Japan's rulers began a crash campaign of industrialization in order to avoid being conquered by the Western powers. And while those powers were carving up bits of China, two of them, the British and the Americans, decided to support Japan's development. They wanted to build up an imperial junior partner in the region. One thing that Japan did for them was to act as a regional cop. Japanese troops joined Western soldiers in putting down the anti-imperial Boxer Rebellion in China at the turn of the 20th century. And just a few years before that, Japan helped put down a peasant uprising in Korea. The results, Japan combined their Korean police action with a war against China. And the results of that were that Japan enlarged its footprint in Korea and occupied Taiwan for the next 40 years. The US and Britain wanted to help Japan expand its regional influence at the expense of their own enemy, Russia. So they supported Japan in its war with Russia in 1904 and 1905. Korea and northern China were the battleground. Most socialists think of that war as the spark that touched off the Russian Revolution of 1905. But Koreans think of it as the moment that Japan took over their country. The war ended when Teddy Roosevelt brokered a deal that recognized Japan's right to hold on to Korea, and in return, Japan endorsed the U.S. occupation of the Philippines, which had begun 7 years before. And for this, Roosevelt got the Nobel Peace Prize. Japan followed up the seizure of Korea by restructuring the country as a profit-producing colony. Southern Korea, which has the best agricultural land, was to supply Japan with rice. In the north, Japanese built factories. Part of the restructuring was social, as the Japanese trained a cadre of Koreans to help administer Japanese rule. They also built a Korean-staffed police force at Japanese command. The regime was harsh and humiliating. The Japanese exploited workers to exhaustion. They made the schools teach in Japanese, and they used thousands of women as prostitutes. Korean resistance came in many forms, including non-cooperation, especially for peasants, assassinations, and guerrilla struggle. The most important outbreak of Korean resistance was the March 1st movement of 1919. At the end of World War I, the peace talks at Versailles promised self-determination for all nations. But really, the winners of the war were out to strip the losers of their colonies. Britain would keep India, France kept Indochina, the US stayed in the Philippines, and their ally, Japan, held on to Korea. There were some pro-independence Korean delegates at Versailles, but they weren't allowed to vote. Back in Korea, students read out a Declaration of Independence, and they sparked off a three-month mass movement. The movement featured students prominently, but it activated members of all classes, with somewhere between 1 million and 2 million participating out of a population of 20 million. The Japanese repressed the movement, but it marked the birth of modern Korean nationalism. It also inspired the creation of dozens of further movements and organizations, including communist groups. U.S. corporations shared in the exploitation of Korea. Even before the 1905 war, U.S. companies had already built and operated major infrastructure in the city of Seoul, including the light plant, the trolley system, and the water supply. In the following decades, American companies used 50,000 Koreans to mine the country's gold. The U.S. alliance with Japan began to break down when Japan began to assert itself as an independent power in the region. Japan used Korea as the launching point for an invasion of China in the 1930s. That's also when forced prostitution, the use of so-called comfort women, expanded to include more than 100,000 Koreans. 200,000 Asians overall. When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, communists in China and Korea became U.S. allies against the Japanese. But after Japan's defeat in 1945, Mao Zedong and Kim Il-sung were designated as U.S. enemies. This reversal corresponded to a major imperial shift. The Soviet Union became the main U.S. rival in the region, while Japan got back on the U.S. side. In the long view of things, the U.S. and Japan have been imperial partners since the late 1800s, with only about 10 years of conflict around World War II. When Japan retreated from Korea at the end of that war, the region's new imperial overlords partitioned the peninsula between Russian and American spheres of influence.
So as White House concluded in an introduction at the end of World War II, the Korean Peninsula was divided into spheres of influence between the Soviet Union, which occupied North Korea, and the U.S., which occupied South Korea. Which the 38th parallel was the dividing line. While these divisions were taking place, I think it's also important to remember that for Koreans, the end of World War II brought the end of Japanese occupation and hope for an independent and unified Korea. This is evident through the creation of the Korean People's Republic. On September 5th, 1945, about a month after the conclusion of the Potsdam Conference, hundreds of independence activists gathered in Gyeonggi Girls High School to proclaim the existence of the Korean People's Republic. Part of their platform read, "We are determined to demolish Japanese imperialism, its residuary influences, anti-democratic factions, reactionary elements, and undesirable foreign influence in our state, and to establish our complete autonomy and independence, thereby anticipating the realization of an authentically democratic state." Their demands included, and it's pretty expansive, it was a 27-point plan, lands to be given to those who work them, complete emancipation of women, an 8-hour workday, an end to child labor, an end to illiteracy, nationalization of major industries and banks, and a major program of rapid industrialization. So obviously I didn't cover the 27-point program, but I think you guys get the idea of what the platform represented. Shortly after the establishment of the Korea's People's Republic, people's committees were established as a way to run the provisional government. By December of 1945, more than 2,546 people's committees, both in North and South, were established at various levels, from villages to cities to varying counties. Just the astronomical number of people's committee that developed in such a short amount of time, and with the hope of the Korea's, actually envisioning the Korea People's Republic, I think that's something to like really wrap your head around. Because it just shows like the potential and the hope that Koreans had during that time. It's also worth noting that during this time period, 1,000 new labor unions formed and led to the National Council of Labor, Korean Labor Unions, known as Chonpyeong, which consisted of at that time 500,000 members. However, the Korea People's Republic was short-lived. It was clear that the ideas of Korea's People's Republic ran contrary to the imperialist aims of both the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Under U.S. military occupation in South Korea, Governor General Hodge, who was the U.S. representative, refused to work with the Korea's People's Republic and ultimately declared them the enemy and banned People's Committees. Under the U.S. military occupation of South Korea, living conditions deteriorated quickly. Over a million people could not find jobs, there was a shortage of food, and hyperinflation made it impossible for Koreans to afford necessities. In Seoul, there was a 3,000% increase just on those basic goods. Uprisings challenging these conditions were often countered with U.S. troops. For example, Koreans attempted to challenge U.S. military occupation in both the October 1946 uprising and later the Jeju uprising. The U.S. military massacred Koreans in the thousands during these uprisings. I wanted to focus more on the Gwangju uprising and the democracy movement, but I think it's definitely worth reading through these movements if you have time. Asia's Unknown Uprising. You have to read it with a grain of salt. I'll go over why later. but just to say that there's really good information there, and if I find more information, I will let you guys know. So the U.S. ultimately installed Syngman Rhee as president of South Korea. As Sidney Lenz described in The Forging of the American Empire, Rhee's greatest virtue, apart from the fact that he had spent 37 of his 70 years in the United States and spoke English, was his rightist philosophy, which attracted landlords and reactionaries to his banner. Under Syngman Rhee's rule and after the Jeju Uprising and the Yosan insurrection, the U.S. established the national security law, essentially mandating the death penalty for the Pyongyang sympathizers, so essentially communists. When the U.S. handed over the police to Rhee, he doubled the police from 34,000 to 60,000, and the number of political prisoners increased from 22,000 in 1947 to 30,000 in 1949. So that's the U.S. and South Korea. Now I want to refocus to the Soviet Union and North Korea. I'm going to start by saying that there are ideas that are held not just by Stalinists, but others on the left, that the role of the Soviet Union was both peaceful and passive in the North. However, we should know that how the Soviet Union established power in North Korea is tactfully different and purposefully so. As Sidney Lenz states in The Forging of the American Empire, the difference in approach between the United States and the Soviet Union is prophetic. In the North, the Soviets attach themselves to nationalism, using the People's Committee as the kernel of government. In the South, Hodge places reliance on Rhee and his band of conservatives. Kim Ha-young, who's wrote The International Viewpoint of the Korean Peninsula, that's the English translation of it, echoed a similar sentiment, stating it meant only that by recognizing the People's Committee and controlling them, the Soviets could realize their interests in Korea. This method looked better and offered more stability than using the old Japanese-staffed administrative organs, which the U.S. did. They had attempted to continue using the Japanese administration, but soon realized that they needed to establish a Korean administration if they were to survive the resistance from the Korean people. And like I said, there's heavy resistance happening in South Korea against the U.S. He also pointed out that the quick occupation of the Soviet Union military into North Korea, so literally days after the divisions were made, the Soviet Union entered into North Korea. And then it was the military occupation, and they shut down two North Korean papers, the Apgang Ilbo and Hwanghae Ilbo, and the rest of Koreans that were suspected to be against the Soviet Union were possible reasons why uprisings like that of the South did not appear in the North. Kim Ha-kyung, Ha-young stated, in this way, the Soviets nipped in the bud popular movements that might otherwise have broadened further. This provides us one of the answers to the questions of why it was that the mass struggles that erupted so fiercely in the South immediately after liberation did not occur in the North. The masses of the North had to face the Soviet occupation army before they even had a chance to wake up properly. Ultimately, both the U.S. and Soviet Union could not agree on a way forward for reunification during the so-called transitional period. The U.S. did not want the communists in the North to rule, and the Soviet Union did not want Rhee Syngman's government to rule also. This ultimately led to South Korea becoming an independent republic in August of 1948 and the formation of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in September of 1948 with Kim Il-sung as premier. U.S. and Soviet Union troops left soon after establishment of these governments, but then enter Korean War. So unfortunately, I don't have time to go through the ins and outs of the history of the Korean War, but wanted to raise a couple of points. Without U.S. involvement in the Korean War, it's highly probable that South Korea's government under Ri would have been defeated by the North. For that reason, the U.S., their involvement was necessary in terms of the strategy of containment of the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The Chinese Revolution changed the Cold War dynamics, and quote unquote, Truman was determined not to let any other country leave the U.S. sphere of influence. For China and the Soviet Union, U.S. involvement in the Korean War meant the possibility of U.S., well, for China specifically, meant the possibility of U.S. invasion in China and thus prompted their involvement in the war. The outcome was a stalemate that continues today. These numbers are astronomical. There were between 2.5 million and 4 million Korean casualties. There's no official peace treaty, and there was a continued occupation by the U.S. in the South. And these dynamics continue today. White House will cover that in 20 minutes. I'm on time, by the way. So I'm not gonna cover the 60s and 70s in detail, but just to say that coming out of the Korean War and with the dictatorship of Ri and overthrowing him, there was something that arose called the Minjung Awaken. George Kotsafikis in Asians Unknown Uprising, South Korean social movements in the 20th century, described Minjung as a name for the cross-class social force that overthrew decades of U.S.-backed dictatorships and shaped Southern Korea into an egalitarian and prosperous society. I believe this part of his statement to be true, meaning that the next few decades led to the overthrow of Syngman Rhee, the assassination of Park Chung-hee, the military coup of Chun Doo-hwan, ultimately leading to two major struggles in South Korea that I'm gonna focus on, which is Gwangju Uprising and the 1987 Democracy Movement. The second part of his statement, the egalitarian and prosperous society, not so much. Korea today is actually one of the most unequal societies in the country, and we should talk about that in the discussion if people wanna raise why. But the 60s and 70s was a time where the working class actually developed. I'll go through that in a second. Okay, so before I get to the Gwangju Uprising and the democracy movement that started in 1987, there's a few things worth noting that happened in the 60s and 70s, because this carries over to the movements in the 80s. There continues to be a support of the South Korean ruling class with military support of the U.S. military. So anytime there's an uprising, they're gonna call the U.S. military to try and either stamp it down or figure out how to get them out of it. Initially, North Korea surpassed South Korea economically. So during this time, North Korea was actually above economically than South Korea. Post-Korean War, South Korea was largely reliant on the U.S. economically. 14% of GNP came in the form of U.S. aid. During the 1970s, the South Korean economy began to rise with an expanding working class, facilitated around an export-oriented industrialization. This book, by the way, Korean workers, like, if you want to know a Marxist analysis of the Korean working class, like, this is the book to read. Read that. And so he goes through actually the beginning of industrialization to the great labor revolts that actually happened in 1987 after the student protests in 1987. With the rise of the working class came the rise of chaebols, huge corporate conglomerates that would come to dominate the South Korean economy. Along with that was the immense growth of colleges, which led to an explosion of the student population. So student protests are actually at the forefront of a lot of Korean uprisings. And part of it is because of the growth of colleges and the student population. And continued relationship between students and workers around struggles and uprising that emerged post-Korean War. So you'll see that dynamic play out. They actually industrialized in the 80s. I'll go through that. These dynamics play an important role into the lead of the Gwangju People's Uprising and the June 1987 Uprising. So the Gwangju People's Uprising. Just curious, how many people have heard of the Gwangju? Cool. Yeah, okay. The reason why this is called hidden history is because the Gwangju uprising is obviously not talked about in the U.S. Very much. So why is it important? Choi Jung-won in this stated he was one of the participants in the Gwangju uprising. In this absolute community, citizens confirmed their greatness, blessed each other, and experienced an absolute liberation from all social bondages and constraints. At this moment, many citizens were plunged into an extreme ecstasy that they would not have minded dying right then and there, and the struggle changed into a festival. So like that's in the midst of what was happening in Gwangju. So that just gives you an idea of like what people felt. And also it's like 2 decades of absolute suppression by the dictatorship, one after another, and then also the suppression of the US military as well. So the fact that this comes out of that is it's very inspiring. In short, it was a renewed sense of hope for Koreans after decades of repression. Just did that. So what actually happened? On May 4th, so I don't know where Gwangju is on the map. I'm not going to lie. There you go. Gwangju. That's why White House is here. I'm horrible with directions. Anyways, 1980, so on May 14th, 1980, over 70,000 students demonstrated in Seoul against the military dictatorship, with sister rallies happening in Gwangju, Busan, and Masan. 1980, the Seoul student statement called for expelling of foreigners who supported dictators and establishing economic independence. Though the student demonstrations halted, the military dictatorship responded by sending thousands of combat troops to large cities, including Gwangju. On May 16, 1980, 50,000 students from 9 universities in Gwangju rallied in front of Province Hall and renamed it Democracy Plaza. In response, the military dictatorship raided homes and arrested as many leaders of the movement as possible. USC's democracy movement, or for the US, they see this democracy movement as communist inspired, therefore doubles down on support of Chun. They don't want this to be another Vietnam. The US military then intervened, which led to altercations between US paratroopers and the military dictatorship against the Korean protesters. First student activists, then workers. One of the most iconic moments was when the bus drivers and taxi drivers joined in the protest, essentially leading the defense line ahead of protesters, confronting the US paratroopers and the military dictatorship. There's actually a really good Korean movie. It's called Taxi Driver. People should watch it. Interestingly, the movement's enemy was the it's worth noting that the movement's enemy was the army and not so much the police, who sometimes opened up armories to the protesters. So that, and then workers of Asia Motors, which is now Kia, opened up the plant for easy access to vehicles. Hwasan coal miners brought dynamite and detonators. Women textile workers drove to Nanju, where they captured rifles and ammunition to bring back to Gwangju. On May 21st, workers and students and protesters of Gwangju effectively took over the city, leading to the Gwangju commune. There's lots of ins and outs of the actual organizing that's worth reading through. The fact that they had 100,000 mass democratic rallies in Democracy Plaza is just like such a mind, my mind is blown. Like, how do you even make that happen? But they did, they made it happen until the 27th, or the 22nd, 27th. The uprising did spread to other cities, and it's actually very interesting. When an uprising happens in Korea, it tends to spread like wildfire in the other cities, and is definitely so for Gwangju. And so it ended on May 27th when the military dictatorship, with the assistance from the US, led an all-out assault against the commune and uprising. But the legacy of Gwangju, though, continues up until the democracy movement in June of 1987. So the Gwangju uprising provided many lessons. And as Hagen Koo pointed out, that after the Gwangju uprising, this is a period of South Korea's social formation, the historic mission of the Minjung movement, and U.S. involvement in a country's destiny. It was a period of Marxism and radical discourse. Many students, intellectuals, and political activists were strongly influenced by Marxism. Dependency perspective or people's liberation theology and embraced the idea of radical social formation through collective action. So immediately, like after the Gwangju uprising, circles, study circles developed, students studied Marx, trying to figure out like what did we do wrong, like how could we push forward in the next uprising. It's kind of remarkable to think about just in terms of, you know, how we think about how we learn from current movements and how we want to push movements forward as Marxists and socialists. This led to a section of Marxist college students to industrialize in the factories leading up to the 1987 democracy movement, and then the 1987 Great Worker Struggle. So the democracy movement happened in June, then there was a wave of strikes that happened in from July to August. The Marxist college students that industrialized understood that the importance of labor and the working class, not only from the Gwangju uprising, but also from the militant Sabuk miner strike and other volatile strikes that occurred in the 80s. Also worth noting, leading into the June uprising of 1987 is the inspiration from the Philippines of the overthrow of President Ferdinand Marcos. As the Chosun Ilbo stated, the ruling party must keep in mind the fact that our countrymen are excited about the Philippine situation as if it were a matter of our own. A month later, Kim Dae-jung, who was exiled by Chun Doo-hwan for participating in the Gwangju uprising and is also a future Korean president in the 90s, wrote in the New York Times, "This is a time of people's power in the developing countries of Asia. We have never been so sure before."
How much time do we have?
You're 21.
Okay, so really quickly, I'll just go through 1987, which is to say that, okay, another movie, 1987, When the Day Comes, everyone should watch that. It's about everything that, it's a Korean movie that is literally everything that happened in 1987. And Chun Doo-hwan, okay, so what started this was Chun Doo-hwan attempted to appoint his second in command, Roh Tae-woo, through popular elections. He thought this was doable with US support. Soon after his announcement, public discontent emerged and augmented, and he suspended constitutional debate. So during this time, there was a dictator in place, who's Chun Doo-hwan, and he's trying to prop up his government and say, we're gonna have elections, for reals this time. But he really doesn't want that to happen. So in January, there was a student, Park Jung-cho, that starts to spearhead some of these events. He's a student that's tortured to death, and nobody knows that he's tortured to death. And a statement was released on May 18th, 1987, documenting the details of his death. On May 27, 1987, students demand a constitutional revision. On June 9th, so there's protests that are happening during this time. I'm just like rattling off dates. If people have questions during, feel free to bring it up in the discussion. But on, I think the turning point in this is on June 9th, 1987, Lee Han-yo was struck by a tear gas canister by the US or the Korean dictatorship. And that led to mass student protests that begin in Seoul and last for 19 days. We're talking hundreds of thousands of students coming out in response to not just Lee Han-yeol, but actually demanding a constitutional revision and actual election, democratic elections that are happening. On June 18th and 19th, Chun orders troops. He tries to order more troops into the protests that are happening. And he meets with the U.S. and cancels the mobilization order. And I think this is important because it's a turn for the U.S. They don't want to rely on Chun Doo-hwan anymore because he's caused all of this upheaval. This U.S. Congressman, Stephen Salar, says it best. $20 billion in trade flows between both countries, making it the seventh largest trading partners with the U.S. It is therefore essential that we reopen negotiations with the Chun government and the opposition, for it is only through such a dialogue that national consensus can be achieved and political stability and continued economic growth and the preservation of peace can be assured. So the U.S. interests were firmly on trying to resolve this, and they didn't think Chun Doo-hwan was the way forward to do that. June 26th, massive nationwide protests happened, and on June 29th, government calls for direct presidential elections and reform. So this massive wave of protests that happened in June leads to the direct, to the overthrow of Chun Doo-hwan and actual government elections that are happening. On July 5th, Lee Han-yol dies, so he was in hospital. And dies, and one of the most iconic pictures of this is like millions of people, like not just students, millions of people rushing into Seoul. Like you see them standing on buses. Oh, okay, Google that picture. It's great. And then on July 10th, July 9th is his funeral. Millions of people attend, and then on July 10th, Chun Doo-hwan resigns. The labor protests are, I'll say this about the labor protests, which is the explosion of labor conflicts in 1987 was largely the product of a sudden political opening created by political dynamics of the civil society. The temporary suspension of authoritarian state intervention in the labor regime provided a golden opportunity for workers to vent their long-suppressed grievances. So you can see the dynamics of both the student and labor protests that are happening during that time. Hyundai also formed their first union.
Wow, that was great. Okay, this is after 1987. The South Korean dictatorship was an imperial client of the United States, but so are the elected governments of the past 30 years. More than 28,000 U.S. troops are still there, and in case of war with the North, the U.S. president is still empowered to take command of South Korea's army, 500,000 soldiers. Hostility to the U.S. presence flares up in many ways. Some hostility is a response to the arrogance and impunity of individuals in the U.S. military as part of their legal status as soldiers in the country. There's also organized opposition, sometimes spearheaded by local residents against a particular U.S. base or weapons emplacement. This includes the ongoing resistance to the deployment of the THAAD anti-missile battery in the town of Songju. And the same is true for the US base on the island of Jeju, which is the blue dot down at the bottom there. US imperialism has weighed much more heavily on the North, of course. The military threat has not let up since the end of the Korean War. The US has targeted the North with nuclear weapons since the late 1950s. And of course, the annual war games in the South are rehearsals for the overthrow of the Northern regime. Less well known is the US economic blockade that's been in place for 68 years. And I don't mean US sanctions. For almost 70 years, the US has treated commerce with North Korea as a crime of trading with the enemy. The USSR was North Korea's long-term imperial patron. This relationship created special dependency on the Soviets because the North was cut off from economic connections to the West and Japan. The benefit for the Russians was to maintain the North as a strategic buffer that separated their country from US troops in the South, a benefit that China also shared. Now, to escape exclusive dependence on the Soviet Union, North Korea reached out to China in the 1960s in a policy that was known as pendulum diplomacy. Russia and China were rivals by then, and Kim Il-sung could bob between the two and shop for the best offers of military or economic assistance. Nevertheless, the USSR remained North Korea's primary sponsor. By the 1980s, economic development started to throw the regional balance of forces into flux. Diana talked a little bit about this. Back in the 40s, the partition of Korea had left the North with plentiful minerals and most of the factories. So the economy did hold its own against the South right up into the 70s. But in the 80s, South Korea's export-driven economy was blowing far past the level of production in the North. The 1980s also marks the beginnings of China's economic breakout. By the late 1980s, both China and the Soviet Union saw the importance of building economic connections with the South and began to scale back their support for the North. In 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed and the North lost its main connection to the world economy. This left China as the North's only real ally, and an ally that really cared more about relations with the South. These events combined with natural disasters to make the 1990s into a catastrophic decade for North Korea. As many as 2 million people died of famine out of 10% of the population. To dig itself out of disaster, North Korea has followed two tracks. One track is renewed militarization. For one thing, military production helps them raise cash. They make good rockets, and they sell them to countries like Iran and Syria that can't buy them from the US or Israel. They've also militarized to defend against renewed threats from the US. With the fall of the East Bloc countries, it seemed possible that the US might start gunning for the rest of its Cold War enemies. The North started to get serious about developing nuclear weapons to deter the US from attacking. But nuclear weapons have a dual use, as a defense measure and as a bargaining chip. For that, they have to work. North Korea didn't get the US into serious negotiations until they had a weapon that poses a credible threat to the United States. So while militarism is track one for the North, the related track two has been to reach out to the US to break out of isolation. The North has reached out every few years since 1991. Lifting the US threat would win relief from the blockade and reduce the need for military spending. A connection with the US could also reduce the North's dependence on China. For this plan of engagement, Kim Jong-un sought the help of the South. To understand this, we should look at the political system that had emerged in the South since the victory of the democracy movement in the late 80s. Elections since the fall of that dictatorship have featured competition between parties that represent two wings of the capitalist class. One wing, familiar, right? One wing is effectively the grouping behind the old military dictatorship. Their last president was Park Geun-hye, who was a daughter of Park Chung-hee, dictator, and she was ousted last spring through a mass movement. And was impeached for corruption. For these politicians, reunification with the North meant simply taking it over. They've also favored despotic workplace relations and other repressive aspects of the old police state. The other wing of the ruling class has been headed by intellectuals and lawyers from the democracy movement. That includes, of course, Kim Dae-jung and the current president, Moon Jae-in. These leaders are the architects of the sunshine policy of engagement with the North. They're somewhat liberal on workers' rights in the South, but both political wings are committed to the neoliberal dominance of management rights. Both wings of the ruling class have been committed to the military alliance with the US, but the sunshine wing is sometimes critical of the US military and of the bossiness of presidents, in particular like George W. Bush and Donald Trump. These politics sometimes intersect with anti-imperial sentiment from below. Popular anger against abuses by U.S. troops played a role in the election of Noh Moo Hyun as president in 2003. He's the middle of the three Sunshine presidents. But all three Sunshine presidents have been loyal imperial clients despite occasional moments of self-assertion. The democracy movement of the late 1980s set up a system where political figures like these are not accountable to the rank and file members of their party. So when these leaders do assert themselves against the U.S., they are expressing a South Korean ruling class interest not to be pushed around by the U.S. Now let's look at the way the Southern establishment has engaged the North in recent months. Throughout the peninsula, the North-South dialogue has raised popular expectations. The Trump-Kim summit raised them higher. These expectations give the process extra momentum because Kim and Moon don't want to disappoint. Kim Jong-un has actively stoked North Korean hopes for a peaceful and prosperous future. He broadcast a heroic 40-minute video of his summit with Trump. He's also replaced the propaganda posters that vilify the U.S. and replaced them with messages about future prosperity. Now, Kim is a dictator, but he's still concerned about or even afraid of what his subjects think of him. It's unlikely that he would drive up popular hopes if his talk of peace were just some kind of maneuver or some kind of ruse. The rulers of North and South have always taken the reunification of East Germany in 1990 as an example that they want to avoid. In that case, the Eastern state collapsed, not a fate that Kim wants. And the West was left with a united country plagued by vastly uneven development. There was mass unemployment and a major strain on the welfare state. North and South Korea are even less evenly matched than Germany was. The North's GDP per capita is less than $2 per day. It's hard to believe. Yearly income in the South is more than $27,000 per capita. So both sets of rulers hope to build inter-Korean connections gradually. The big conglomerates, the chaebol, like Hyundai and Samsung, have spent decades trying to sketch out the methods and the costs of integrating the two economies. A recent report from Samsung calculated reunification costs on a model of integration rather than absorption. That's a quote from their report. It would not require the economic promotion and social security expenditures included in German-style reunification costs. Instead, costs could be channeled chiefly into rebuilding North Korean infrastructure, end of quote. A second phase could include mining and light manufacture. Finally, would come IT work and manufacturing for export. Peace would also mean that everybody's military costs might go down. What's more, regional profits could rise from connections that pass through the North. If Southern rail lines could link with Chinese and Russian ones, then Kias and Hyundais could get shipped to Europe cheaply by rail. Russian gas could be pumped to both Koreas and maybe extended under the ocean to Japan. The vision of gradual reintegration squares well with proposals for an extended period of political confederation between the two that preserves the northern establishment. I'll look at China's role next, and then I'll close with some thoughts about what's in store for popular politics in Korea. China favors progressive relaxation of sanctions with every step that North Korea takes toward denuclearization. The Trump administration is giving in to this position because they don't have much choice. China has started letting workers back into Chinese factories, and they've resumed the import of coal from the North. China is well placed to invest in the North if more sanctions are lifted. When Kim made his third trip to China in June, 3 and 3 months, the Korea Herald remarked that by shuttling between Trump and Xi Jinping, he's already reviving the pendulum diplomacy that his grandfather practiced. The first Kim was famous for his Juche idea, a doctrine that calls for self-reliance. North Korea has tried to pursue self-reliance in some areas of the economy, but it's a small country, and Juche has been more of an attitude about political independence than a real program of economic self-reliance. China is still to be the main patron, but the idea of a pendulum is that a connection with one major power can provide leverage against the other. Case in point, in the month that Trump met Kim, China reopened tourism to North Korea. Tourism is a significant source of foreign exchange for the North. It's also something that the regime can promote without disrupting the country's authority relations. That's one reason Kim wanted to learn about Singapore when he was there. It's a one-party regime whose biggest economic sector is tourism. While Kim wants to use a relationship with the U.S. as occasional leverage against China, he also needs China's help to stabilize his regime, both militarily and economically. In contrast, this is a role that the Soviet Union decided not to play in Eastern Europe in 1989. This applied specifically to East Germany, where the Russians had more than 100,000 troops. They decided not to prop up the regime as the citizens revolted. Now, the war games in the South are about a takeover of the North in case of revolt or collapse, riots, or a mass exodus of refugees. China also has plans for such contingencies. They've signaled more than once that they would intervene if the South and the U.S. launch an invasion. Chinese force is thus the usually unmentioned deterrent against U.S. aggression alongside North Korean rockets and bombs. China does have an interest in denuclearization because Northern militarism gives the U.S. an excuse to build up its own regional forces, which can also be used against China. The gradual plan for Confederated Korea also suits the Chinese, because U.S. troops wouldn't be moving up to the Chinese border anytime soon. And of course, reunification would deepen Chinese economic relations with South Korea, while potentially opening up more low-wage work by North Koreans, which of course South Koreans would also want to exploit. This does not guarantee that China would be the big winner against the U.S. if peace breaks out on the peninsula. Both northern and southern regimes have signaled that they want a U.S. military presence to remain to balance out Chinese and Japanese power. And while the North is unlikely to become a U.S. ally, Kim's posture suggests that the U.S. could gain some influence with the North at China's expense. So the big imperial winner here, I think, is really up for grabs. There are lots of unknowns about how this is going to work out. Okay, I'll close with some thoughts on popular politics in Korea. First, about the South. Moon's election in May was a defeat for the hardline right. Elections last month extended the defeat of the right into the localities, mayors and provincial governors. If the threat of war with the North really does lift, many South Koreans may start to question why their country must serve as a forward base for the U.S. rivalry with China. The end of peninsular hostilities could thus serve as a clarifying experience that gives new life to anti-imperial politics in South Korea. That, of course, would deal a further blow to the political right and open up political options for the left. The left, however, is not united over how reunification should go, and this division may delay mass mobilizations for some time. So while there are clearly plans for reunification from above by multiple ruling classes, there's not yet a clear program for reunification from below. Other social movements are simmering however, there is, for example, a strong Me Too movement, which I think could also apply to the treatment of Korean women by American GIs. Mm-hmm. Now, in the North, there is sharp class polarization, including hatred of the wealth and the arrogance of the rich. If foreign capital reaches more of North Korea, workers could revolt against the typical pay arrangement where the company pays the state, which then decides how much goes out to the workers' wages. Now, freedom of movement and freedom of travel to the South in particular could become a major issue. Remember, the precipitating cause of the fall of East Germany was the exodus of thousands of East Germans to the West. Nevertheless, even if a significant number of Northerners were able to move south, they may suffer discrimination from Southerners, as asylum seekers do already. This highlights a general point. The South Korean left is entering a period of expanded responsibilities. They will need to put forward politics of open borders and solidarity against discrimination. They need to think about ways to articulate a vision of revolutionary reunification from below, along with concrete steps to build solidarity along the way. They'll need to think of demands and slogans and campaigns that make sense to ordinary people in the South and in the North. That is where our own internationalism has to be focused, on expanding the openings for ordinary Koreans. There will be specific things that we can do in solidarity, but our biggest job is to hold back U.S. imperial designs for the region, including designs against China. That would multiply the options available for our comrades in Korea.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.